Our next case is 13-1177, Claremont County Transportation Improvement District versus Gator Milford, LLC. For the appellant, Mr. O'Connor.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, my name is Brian O'Connor. I'm joined here today by trial counsel Bill Santin, Jr. We represent the appellant, Gator Milford, LLC. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel, can you move the microphone a little closer?
Sure.
Thank you.
We're here today because the 12th District Court of Appeals added an unwritten exception to Appellate Rule 4. As you know, Appellate Rule 4 governs the timeliness of an appeal in Ohio. It requires that an appellant file his notice of appeal within 30 days after entry of a final judgment, or if service of that final judgment is not made in accordance with Civil Rule 58B, 30 days after service is in fact made. Appellate Rule 4 is a tolling provision. It has it in there for instances in which service is not made on a party. But the 12th District found that exception to be inapplicable in cases when appellant has actual knowledge of the judgment entry. This exception was crafted without legal authority. It's in direct conflict with other district courts of appeals, and if allowed to stand, it will result in a host of negative consequences. Because we're here on a certified conflict, I want to talk briefly about the two conflict cases. In both of the cases that confront you, the courts of appeals found that service had not occurred. The Gator Milford court found this lack of service to be immaterial. They wrote without any legal citation in their opinion, quote, due process does not require service of a document that has been previously provided. In contrast, the Bambi Motel decision from the 10th District Court of Appeals found this lack of service to be crucially relevant. There, the appellant tried to appeal from an agreed permanent injunction entry 2 years after the agreed permanent injunction entry had been crafted. And the court found that service in accordance with Civil Rule 58B had not occurred, and that was the ultimate deciding factor in the 10th District case. The court in Bambi Motel held that, quote, appellant's actual knowledge of the agreed permanent injunction is insufficient to begin the running of the time for appeal in the absence of formal notice in compliance with Civil Rule 58B. And I would suggest to you that that is the right result. That's what I urge you to adopt today. This court should.
What would be the consequence if we adopted your interpretation? In other words, if we say the Bambi Motel decision trumps what happened in this case?
I'm not sure I understand your question by what
well,
you
is
mean.
There any negative consequences here? I mean, obviously, the opposite would be trying to prove actual notice. You know, what would suffice for actual knowledge at when notice was not formally given pursuant to the appellate rules? There would be that. What I would call the murky area of trying to figure out if there was knowledge that would trigger the 30 days.
Absolutely, and I think that's why the Bambi Motel decision is right. I think that if you do not adopt the 10th District's approach to this, the next case that's going to confront a district court of appeals or this court is not going to be one in which my client admits that there was actual knowledge, but there's going to be somebody out there where there's this murky gray area, and as Justice O'Donnell said in the last case, this court is not a fact finder. The district courts of appeals are not fact finders. There's a reason that courts of appeals rely on the cold, hard, objective record, and that's because John Q. Smith can walk into the Claremont County Clerk of Court's office and determine whether an appeal is timely. If you adopt the 12th District's rationale below, we're going to start shifting from the objective, cold, hard record to a party's subjective knowledge, and that's simply ill-suited for a court of appeals.
Counsel, if we can clarify for a second, the certified conflict question speaks to actual knowledge.
Sure.
I think both parties in this case, everybody agrees, actual knowledge by itself is not enough. Would you agree then what we're talking about is service? It can't just be knowledge, it has to be service.
I agree with you. I think that's the answer to this case, is that at the end of the day, the sine qua non for a running of a time for appeal is service.
And did we have service in this case? Did the 12th District agree that there was actual service? Or, I mean, the opinion seems a little unclear on that point in my mind as to whether they found there was actual service or was there just a copy that was received?
Well, absolutely, Justice French. And what we had here was we had a certificate of service at the end of a judgment entry from the trial court's bailiff simply saying, I hereby certify that a copy of this judgment entry was served on all parties and or counsel of record and signed by the bailiff. Then a two-line entry went on from the clerk of courts simply copying verbatim that line. And your question, though, was has the 12th District explicitly found that service did or did not occur? And I would say that I concede that they did not make a formal finding that service did not occur, but I think it's implicit throughout their entire opinion, both in the entry dismissing the appeal and in the entry certifying a conflict. When they write things like due process does not require service of a document that has been previously provided, the only reason you would write that is if you would believe that service had not occurred. Throughout their entry granting the motion to dismiss the appeal, they make statements like the appellee argues that the appellant acknowledges that he received a copy of the appeal, and we've never once disputed that. What we have disputed is that there was formal service. And I don't think that there was. There absolutely was not. If you look at Civil Rule 58B, which governs whether there was service, the first sentence says that a trial court has to endorse upon its entry instruction to the clerk to serve the parties and to note it or to provide the parties with notice of the date of judgment. That didn't occur here. There was no instruction from the Court of Common Pleas to the clerk of courts. And as a result of that, the
counsel,
clerk
let me stop you there, because sure. You've got my interest up on the Court of Appeals says apparently a final judgment entry was apparently never prepared. Is that a problem?
No, it's not. What they were referring to
there. That is what they found.
They write that statement, and I would like
and
to
you say it's not a problem.
It's not a problem, Your Honor. Okay. What happened, Justice O'Neill, was the decision from the Court of Common Pleas occurred in November 27 of 2012, and there was not an instruction to the clerk of courts. So what trial counsel did was said, please, Your Honor, will you instruct the clerk to serve this? Will you do something? He said the trial counsel sent the court a letter, and I believe also filed a motion for a final appeal order, just basically trying to push the Court of Common Pleas to serve this entry. And nothing happened there, but that does not mean that the decision on the November 27, 2012 was not a final appeal order. I don't think there's a jurisdictional issue in this court.
Well, on November 27th of 2012, the entry reads, decision entry filed, copy distributed to all parties and or counsel of record.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So that was what was mailed to counsel, am I correct?
By the judicial bailiff, never once by the clerk of courts.
And journalized by the clerk.
Journalized by the clerk without...
And your argument is that the November 27th entry is not a final appealable order. Am I understanding your argument correctly?
Oh, absolutely. The November 27 entry is a final appealable order. I'm suggesting that service of it did not occur until January 30, 2013.
Well, subsequent to that, in January, your client moved the court to make the November 27th entry final and appealable. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And subsequently, the court ordered the clerk to serve the November 27th entry, and that was done when?
The service of the November 27th entry was done in January 30, 2013.
Well, that gets back to what Justice French was asking about whether this is a service question or an entry question.
Well, I don't believe that it's a service question, to get back to her question, to get back to Justice French's question, because the certified conflict comes to you with two cases that have found that service did not occur. The 10th District explicitly found service did not occur, and I would say that the 12th District below, implicit throughout their findings, are many statements which suggest they're relying on the fact that service
had
not occurred.
What do we do with the language that says copy distributed to all parties and or counsel of record? Doesn't that indicate that service had been made of the November 27th entry at or about that time?
Sure. I think a great way to put this in context, in the appellant's merit brief at Appendix A5 and A6, I reproduced for you two sheets from the docket entry of the Clerk of Courts of Claremont County. A5 is what happened on this November 27 entry, the two lines that you're referring to. A6 is what happened in every other instance in which service, formal service in accordance with Civil Rule 58B, had to happen. And on the A6, when formal service occurs, you have things like a party's name, address, the manner of service, the tracking number, the cost of that postage. That's what the Claremont County Clerk of Courts does in any time in which service is required.
So there's only one way to make service, and that's through a directive to the clerk of courts to then go through the process you just described and determine who was served, by what method, and the cost associated with it. And so the alternative that was done here via facsimile slash email slash regular U.S. mail this 27th day of November to all counsel of record and unrepresented parties, which was an action that presumably took place in the bailiff's office,
yes,
or the, you know, the outer chambers of the court, is insufficient.
It's absolutely insufficient.
And that's your argument here.
The argument we are asking is that, and we are saying that comes straight from Civil Rule 58B. There's a reason that the rule prescribes precisely what has to happen for service to occur. In the
you know, if this is a regular course of conduct to have the bailiff send out, presumably by fax or however it goes, to the counsel of record, and that is that supposed to be done as a courtesy, or is that supposed to be done as a substitute?
It's done as a courtesy. So to answer your question, is it a regular practice for a judge's bailiff to provide a courtesy copy? Yes, absolutely, but it is not a regular practice for that to substitute as service. And again, going back to the docket sheets, if you look at every other entry in this case that had to be formally served, you'll see that it was different. And I think that is the best example, perhaps, that this was an irregularity. I suspect what happened in this case was there were two pending post-trial motions. Recall, this was originally appealed immediately after the judgment entry, and the 12th District dismissed the appeal for the first time for lack of a final appealable order because there were two pending post-trial motions. One was a motion for attorney's fees, and one was a motion for the distribution of the appropriations award. The Court of Common Pleas, when they returned jurisdiction from the first appeal, had an entry and had a decision on the motion for attorney's fees. It did not yet have a decision on the motion for distribution of an award. That fight happened for another 2 months. And what the Court of Common Pleas wanted to do was to bundle it up nicely for one giant appeal for the 12th District. And so it withheld service on the first decision so that it could make the decision on the motion for distribution of an
Counselor,
award.
Counselor, here's where I'm getting hung up.
Sure.
The certified question has two parts. The first part says whether actual knowledge and receipt of a judgment entry that is a final appealable order begins the 30-day time period.
Sure.
I can go down to the courthouse and I can pick up actual knowledge of an entry and I can get a copy of that entry. I don't think anybody agrees that that begins the 30-day time clock. So is there anybody in this case who thinks that we could answer a yes to that question?
I would submit that I think that the 12th District, if you read the opinion, I think so.
You think it was only, it didn't have to do with service, meaning service by a bailiff or service by anybody else. It's just actual knowledge.
That's what the 12th District relied upon. They said due process doesn't require formal service of a document that's been previously provided, and they said that our arguments that formal service in accordance with Civil Rule 58 had to occur elevates form over substance. I'm recalling a case from this court in 2007, Glioso, I think the respondent was a university urologist, that had to do with service of a summons and a complaint at the trial court level. And what this court held was that if a defendant hadn't received a copy of a summons, the court was without jurisdiction and an affirmative defense of a lack of jurisdiction held. I would suggest that that's analogous. What we're suggesting here is that formal service in accordance with Civil Rule 58B has to happen.
But that's different. I mean, we can talk about different manners of service, but this refers to knowledge, and that's completely different from service. You can have a lot of different methods of service from the court and from parties, but we can at least all agree that we have to answer no to that question.
I think so,
okay.
And I think that resolves the certified conflict.
Yeah. And then from there, we can talk about what kind of service is necessary.
Sure.
Okay.
But I would say briefly, I see my time is running short, but to resolve the certified conflict that's before you, I think a narrow decision from this court can simply say actual knowledge is not a substitute for service. And by saying that, you avoid having to go through and determine whether service occurred in
Counsel,
this case.
Counsel, this case goes beyond actual knowledge. There was actual service by the bailiff, was there not?
Absolutely not. If you look at Civil Rule 58B, service has to occur by the clerk of courts.
But in this case, it's not just knowledge. There was a piece of paper that you have acknowledged was received.
I would suggest that is.
You're saying it was received by the wrong person.
We may be playing a game of semantics, Justice O'Neill, but I think that you're suggesting service. I would say that's actual receipt. We do not dispute that we actually received the judgment entry, and as Justice French said, we could have gone down and gotten a copy. The fact that we got it from the judicial bailiff is immaterial. We could have got it from a janitor at the
court. Statute doesn't empower the bailiff to substitute for the court or for the clerk of courts.
Absolutely, Chief Justice.
Thank you.
I see my time is running short. I'd like to
a hypothetical question. If the entry is journalized on March 1st and service is made by the clerk on March 5th, when does the notice of appeal begin to run in your view?
Well, under Appellate Rule 4, you have 3 days for the clerk of courts to make service. So under your example, it would have been 5 days.
Yes.
So there's a tolling provision, and you have 30 days after the clerk of courts formally serves the party. So in your example, it would be April 5th of that year.
And if the clerk had made service on March 2nd,
it would be 30 days from the entry of the journal because the tolling provision only provides.
You go back to the date of the journal.
Yes.
Unless the clerk is delayed beyond the 3-day period.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Except the rule doesn't refer to service by the clerk. Isn't that right there is the crux of it, is the rule only refers to, if it doesn't occur the way it's supposed to occur, then you go 30 days from service. And the question here is, okay, what does that mean?
Appellate Rule 4 doesn't refer to the clerk of courts serving it because it incorporates Civil Rule 58B. And Civil Rule 58B does, in fact, talk about what the clerk of courts has to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Bennett. I represent the Claremont County Transportation Improvement District. Justice O'Neill, I want to go to your question to start off with. You asked Appellant Gator Milford, press them, were you served? And their contention was, no, they were not served. It was a courtesy copy. And our contention is it is service. And when we really boil this case down to what the dispute is, they are saying that service needs to be made by the clerk and only the clerk. That's the only arm of the court or other officer of the court that can make service. We disagree with that. So
what's your basis for authorizing a bailiff to do that?
Sure. So Appellate Rule 4A simply references service. It doesn't specify who. And Appellate Rule 4A does reference Civil Rule 58B, mm-hmm. but it's the 3-day period. In fact, the 3-day period, I believe, is expressly stated in Appellate Rule 4A. So Appellate Rule 4A doesn't incorporate all of the requirements of 58B into Appellate Rule 4A. It incorporates the requirement of service. So we go to Civil Rule 5B. Civil Rule 5B says how service is made. We have 6 or 7 different ways that service can be made, and it discusses proof of service. And on top of the clear reading of the rules, we have this court's decision in Hughes, where the facts in Hughes were the clerk did not make service. It was opposing counsel personally delivering to the Attorney General a copy of the final appealable order. And this court presented with those facts an argument from the Attorney General that's identical to the proposition of law being made by Gator Milford, that it has to be the clerk and only the clerk and you have to have the docket. This court said no, there was service in compliance with Civil Rule 5B, and that's the test. So that's where we are. We think the record is crystal clear. We've got a certificate of service attached to the November 27th, 2012 final appealable order. So we're not talking about a jurisdictional, as a counsel conceded. We have a final appealable order. We have a certificate of service. We have proof of service by the bailiff. And we have 3 methods. We have email, which is permitted under Civil Rule 5B. We have mail, U.S. mail, also permitted under Civil Rule 5B. And we have fax. So we have 3 permitted methods of service. And we know service was, in fact, received, because the day after service was made on appellant, appellant writes a letter to the trial court saying, I think appellant acknowledges that the final rulings had been made. So we have actual service and we have receipt of service.
And your view is that the November 27th, 2012 entry became final on November 27th, and the time to file the appeal then expired on December 27th.
Right. So, Justice O'Donnell, getting back to the question that you asked counsel in terms of the timing mechanism.
Yes.
So, the hypothetical, let's say the judgment is entered on day one. In terms of calculating the deadline to appeal, you've got a three-day period for service to be completed. If service is completed on day one, day two, day three, you use the date of the entry. So the notice of appeal would have to be filed on day 30. If you have service not within day one, two, or three, but day four or five or whenever, that is when the appeal is told. And you have 30 days from when service is completed. And that's the tolling provision, and that's the aspect of Civil Rule 58B that's being incorporated into Appellate Rule 4A, not the requirement that the clerk and only the clerk complete service. And that's
What do you make of the motion then that Gator Milford filed in January asking the court to make the entry a final appealable order? What's the import of that motion?
That's a good question, and I don't know, but it looks to me like there was some confusion on their end as to whether the November 27th order was final appealable.
But pursuant to that motion, the court made an entry ordering the clerk to serve the November 27th order, which it did.
Right.
Which the clerk did.
Right.
And so arguably, Gator Milford now says, well, obviously that became the final order because it's in compliance with the rules and the appellate rules, and therefore we have 30 days from that date.
Well, I don't think there's any dispute that the final appealable order was placed on the docket on November 27th. So the question is then, when is it served? That's what Gator Milford is arguing, is they're saying we were not served until the subsequent service made by
the clerk.
So is
that superfluous, the subsequent service that was ordered by the court?
With respect to the calculating the deadline to file a timely appeal, yes.
Why would a court do that?
Well, I think the trial court recognized that Civil Rule 58B requires the trial court to instruct the clerk to serve. And the trial court acknowledged...
And you think that's waivable or mitigated in some way by the operation of Rule 5B?
I think that for purposes of calculating the deadline to file a timely notice of appeal, whether the clerk makes service, whether the strict requirements of Civil Rule 58B are met by the trial court, are not applicable if you have evidence of service separately, which is what we have here. We have undisputed evidence that there was.
But aren't you inviting us down a kind of a slippery slope there? Because I'm not sure when I read the bailiff's notation how service was accomplished. Did he fax it? Did he email it? Did he hand it to him? Or did he mail it to him?
So I think the certificate of service delineates exactly how it was served.
He did all of them?
All of them, yes. Three separate methods.
Go ahead.
Are you suggesting that service is actual receipt of the order? Are you saying that? Because you get to Justice French's earlier question. Let's say that on the second day I haven't received anything, but I'm a party, and I go to the clerk's office, and I see a signed J.E., and I take a copy. Does that mean I'm served?
No. So to... You know, Justice O'Donnell's typical question of, you know, how should this court write the opinion? It's Civil Rule 5B. We know what service is, and that's the test. And so if you have actual knowledge by whatever method, but you don't have service, proper service under Civil Rule 5B, then under Appellate Rule 4A, service has not been completed and the deadline to appeal has been told.
Well, so, a document is served under the rule by handing it to a person.
That's correct.
5-2A.
Correct.
And under this scenario that was just described both by Justice French and Justice Lansinger, if I go down to the clerk's office and I ask for a copy, it's handed to me. Why is that not service under your scenario?
So the facts, your hypothetical is you go to the clerk and the clerk simply hands you a copy of the entry.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question would be, well, what is the evidence in the record to suggest that service was been completed? If the clerk hands you the entry, and there's proof that the clerk handed you the entry, then whether you, under Civil Rule 5B, are various methods to complete service, whether it's hand delivery, like we had in Hughes, or whether it's by mail, you still have acceptable service under Civil Rule 5B.
But so what you're saying is if you go down there and you pick up your own copy, that's service.
Well, I think, again, we have a separate matter of the proof.
Right.
So, yes, if you go down and the clerk of courts hands you a copy, signs a certificate of service saying, I personally delivered to Justice O'Connor a copy of the final appealable order, then yes, I think you have service. I think what's going to happen most of the time in your hypothetical is that there's not going to be proof of
Precisely.
Service.
Precisely. It's just going to be the acquiring of a copy.
Right.
Not a certified copy, just a copy.
Right.
So then why isn't the entry that's signed by the judge, which says copies delivered to the parties, how does that jibe with what you've just said? Is that actual proof that these parties did receive the copy?
You're referring to the entry on the docket?
To the entry. Let's say a judgment entry signed by the judge, which says copies supplied to the parties. You're saying that is proof that it actually was delivered.
I think if we were to look at the docket entry alone, I think it's a question. I think where we have better evidence than that.
But isn't that where we get to the idea of the clerk sending the notice, sending the entry itself by the clerk? And in this particular case, in January, where the court ordered the clerk of courts to send out the copies, that's the official proof of the service, is it not?
In most cases, that is going to be the proof of service. We noted in our brief that a lot of the cases cited by Appellant Gator Milford, where there's a line in the case saying the clerk never issued service, is not so much saying that the clerk has to issue service and only the clerk can issue service, but a reflection of the fact that service was never made.
But you're saying here an alternative to the clerk issuing service was made. Now, was the service that was made, or the copies that were faxed, mailed, or emailed to the parties, was that docketed in the clerk's office?
When you say docketed, meaning other than the November 27th entry on the docket saying...
The entry is there, but the service, was that docketed?
So the service by the bailiff saying, I served by email, I served by regular mail, I served by fax, no, it wasn't.
Isn't that important?
Well, according to this court in Hughes, it's not. That element was missing from Hughes. And I'd say, going back to, let's start with Appellate Rule 4A. We're evaluating whether an appeal is untimely or not. So it starts with the appellate rules. Appellate Rule 4A references service. It doesn't incorporate into Appellate Rule 4A the requirement in Rule 58B that it be docketed. And that's why this court was not troubled by that.
What this case is really about, though? In January, they thought, oh, my gosh, has my 30 days run and I'm still waiting for an entry from the clerk? And aren't you troubled by Rule 58B that's got that word shall in it all those times?
As a direction to the trial court, it says shall, yes. But as this court found in Hughes, in terms of calculating the deadline to file an appeal, whether you have service by the clerk and only the clerk, or notation on the docket by service of the clerk.
But I think that's what this case is about, is we're trying to figure out when does the 30 days start running.
Right.
And you've got a rule that says, court, when you issue an entry, you shall tell the clerk to serve the parties.
Yes.
Shall.
We do, but it's
and
a civil...
And that didn't happen here until January.
Well, I'm not arguing that the clerk completed service until January, correct.
Okay.
Counsel,
correct.
In your view, do we have to overrule Hughes in order to adopt the proposition of law presented by the appellant? Would we have to overrule Hughes?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Then what do we do with our decision in Anderson?
So I believe the record in Anderson reflected the fact that there was no service made. Anderson didn't cite to Hughes. Anderson didn't overrule Hughes. And in fact, there was a subsequent appellate court decision, I think from the 7th District, the Flynn case, where that court reconciled Hughes and Anderson, ultimately concluded that the distinction was in Hughes, there was proof of service. And like in our case here, there was proof of service. Where in Anderson, there was not proof that service was actually made. And that's, again, that's the, what we're advocating is the test, service. Service is the test.
Should we say that the notice issued by the bailiff was a courtesy copy and services made by clerks? Does that clarify anything if we say, a lot of times judges want lawyers to know that decisions have been made. So I'll send you a courtesy copy and then pay attention to what may come from the clerk's office or what service you might receive of this in an official capacity.
So are you asking if a pronouncement from this court that only the clerk can complete service may
I guess
clarify
I'm asking
things?
Whether we should designate others as courtesy copies, which some judges have adopted as policies in their individual courtrooms outside the rules. They sort of adopted a policy like that for some courts.
Well, I think appellant's description of what we believe is a service copy as a courtesy copy is necessitated by the fact that if they acknowledge that service was completed by the bailiff, then Hughes is a straightforward application of Hughes would result in the appeal being laid.
But we then could run into a whole myriad of people making service on judgments, bailiffs, schedulers, all manner of officers in courts making lawyers aware or clients aware of determinations made by courts, and we'd have a myriad of rules as to when we're beginning the notice of appeal for the 30-day period to run.
Right, and it's a good question. I think the important point is that service is the way litigation has been done for years. We have a rule on service. No system is going to be perfect, but service is used for the complaint. Service is used for calculating deadlines to respond to motions, to respond to discovery.
But let me get back to the question I asked about the docketing. You say the November 27th journal entry was docketed.
The
clerk of court's docket.
Your question was, did the clerk's docket specifically note that service was made by email, by fax, by personal mail? And I acknowledge as a factual matter,
did not. Okay,
when
you look at a docket, which is supposed to be the notice to the world of what's being, you know, filed in this case, it's kind of the chronological history, and then you go to look for the documents inside the file to figure out where you are. It wasn't a separate service made on a such and such date. It was the journal entry was filed November 27th, correct?
Correct.
There was never a November 27th service made or whatever the notation would be had the clerk delivered the service, correct?
Correct.
And that's what I think the difference, one of the differences here is that when the clerk makes service, it is contained on the docket for parties, all parties to just look at the docket, they can pull it up electronically, et cetera, and say, oh my gosh, service was made, it was mailed out on this day, I better look for it, or I'm late, or whatever the consequences are. But you don't have that notice under this scenario to the parties and the world that service was made.
I, for the most part, you're right, but you do have notice to the parties that the order was entered and that the order was served.
How do you have that?
Because we have a certificate of service from the bailiff.
Which is it could be looked at as a courtesy copy that was given as a heads up.
I think that's the crux of the issue. If this court determines that service by, the, or I should say, because I don't want to use the word service, but if a copy of the order is sent by the bailiff by fax, by email, by personal mail, and we've got proof of it on a certificate of service, if this court determines that that's just a courtesy copy and not service under Civil Rule 5B, then...
It's just in conflict with Rule 58.
Correct, but it's not in conflict with Appellate Rule 4A, which contains the tolling provision.
And if we were to see this otherwise, we would have to overrule Hughes because Hughes discussed all three rules that we're discussing today.
If this court were to adopt the proposition of law advanced by Gator Milford, absolutely this court needs to overrule Hughes, because in Hughes there was no service by the clerk, and there was no notation, not even a more informal notation, no notation on any level whatsoever in Hughes that service was completed. But to this court in Hughes, the fact that there was service in compliance with Civil Rule 5B was enough to start the clock.
Thank you. Mr. O'Connor, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Counsel, if you could address that last point. I'm over here. If you could address that last point, do we have to overrule Hughes to adopt your proposition of law?
Absolutely not. If your question was, do I think Hughes was wrongly decided? Yes, but I don't think you need to subject it to, for instance, a Glatis analysis and over, because the certified conflict confronts you with two appellate districts' opinions having found that service did not occur. You can simply accept that and then answer the certified question. Is actual knowledge sufficient substitute for service? And the answer is no. If you want to delve into the service question or readdress Hughes, I would suggest that it was wrongly decided under Glatis. You have a duty to discard your former errors. There's been no undue reliance on it. As the chief pointed out, there's notation problems in Hughes. There's a host of issues.
We also have the fact that this has been, 14 years or better since we've had the Hughes case, or wasn't Hughes in, what, that was a 93
92,
case?
I believe, Your Honor.
Okay, and then Bambi was how long ago?
98, I believe.
All right, so this doesn't crop up very often.
It does not, and that's all the more reason why I think this court's preference for a narrow decision need not reach the underlying merits of Hughes. We can simply look and say, the 12th District clearly found that service had not occurred, and that's right in accordance with Civil Rule 58B. And so the certified conflict comes, is there exception that they crafted without any legal authority valid?
But that just begs the question of what did they mean by service? I think what your friends on the other side would say is, no, they said that actual knowledge isn't enough. We weren't just talking about actual knowledge. We were talking about a bailiff that had a certificate of service that actually served it under Rule 5. Now, I know you wanted service under Rule 58, but it was service.
That's right, and they advanced these same arguments at the trial court and the appellate court below, and each time both the trial court and the District Court of Appeals rejected that, found that service had not occurred, and that's how it confronts this court.
Mr. O'Connor, can I get a clarification?
Sure, Your Honor.
The November 27th, 2012 entry, I know it says that the decision had been filed and copies to all parties and or counsel of record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that entry served on anyone by the clerk?
By the clerk? Absolutely not.
That was not served.
The first time.
So the reference in that entry, that copy distributed to all parties and or counsel, is an incorporation of what the bailiff allegedly had done.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And so that was filed in the clerk's office as a docket entry, but the clerk never served that docket entry on any party to the case.
Absolutely, and I recall in the appellee's argument that the chief asked why would the trial court instruct the clerk to serve it on January 30, and the reason was, and we have a copy of the transcript of proceeding that's been recited in the brief, the trial court itself said, you were served as a practical matter by my office, but I don't believe you were served in accordance with Civil Rule 58, which is what's required by the rule. And that's what my client urges you here today to do, to reverse. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Marsha, will you call a recess, please?